This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. In this episode, we're asking whether it's time our train services were renationalised, and what would happen if they were. Last month, the trade journal Rail Business Intelligence magazine reported that the government was considering taking over the private train service that includes Southern Rail. That's the service blighted by strikes and disruption.
For that period over the summer, they destroyed my life.
My mum couldn't put me to bed on time because of the trains.
The once private tracks were renationalised 15 years ago when the national company that owned them, Railtrack, fell into financial difficulty. Would the train services that run on them be better if they were nationalised too? It's not just some Southern Rail commuters who think so. Opinion polls regularly find popular support for train services to be renationalised. Gradual renationalisation of the railways is now even official Labour Party policy.
It was wonderful to see conference this morning agree on our new plan to bring the private franchises into public ownership as they expire. Labour's policy now is to deliver the fully integrated, publicly owned railway the British people want and need.
So, could it happen? What would it mean for rail passengers and all of us as taxpayers? And would it be a better solution than private ownership? The Briefing Room asked an advocate of renationalisation to state the gist of his case.
My name's Laurie McFarlane. I'm an economist at the New Economics Foundation, and this is why I think the rail network should be brought back into public ownership. One of the main justifications given for rail privatisation was that it would reduce the level of taxpayer subsidies, so free up public revenue to be spent on other priorities. Like most countries, Britain's rail system is loss-making, so there's not enough revenue in the system to meet operating costs, capital investment, and in the case of the UK, the claims of shareholders. While direct subsidies to the private train operating companies have been falling, government grants paid to Network Rail, which is the publicly owned company tasked with owning and managing the network, have increased dramatically. Far from producing a better deal for the taxpayer, privatisation has seen the amount of taxpayer support more than double, from £2 billion in 1990 to nearly £5 billion in 2015, after adjusting for inflation.
On the face of it, that might seem like privatisation is working. The level of subsidy to the private train operating companies has fallen, while more funding has gone to the state-owned organisation running the tracks. But for Laurie McFarlane, that's still an indirect subsidy to the private sector, and here's why.
Train operating companies are required to pay Network Rail a fee to access the rail network. But these charges have been consistently kept below the level required to cover Network Rail's costs. And so a larger public grant has been needed to plug the shortfall resulting from these artificially low rail access charges. In economic terms, this is equivalent to a subsidy for the private train operating companies.
And Laurie says this indirect subsidy means the private train operators can turn a profit regardless of how well or badly they perform.
In 2014, the private train operating companies paid out nearly £200 million in dividends to private shareholders. These profits had little to do with capital investment or innovation. Instead, they're sustained thanks to this complex subsidy system, which hides the economic reality and creates an illusion of financial self-sufficiency and profitability. Without this generous public subsidy, the private train operating companies wouldn't be generating any profit today.
So the idea that privatisation would relieve the taxpayer of the need to subsidise the railways has turned out, says Laurie, not to be the case. And for those who think that a state-owned company could never run the train services in Britain, there's a surprise.
One of the great ironies of the debate on the UK rail system is that many of these train operating companies are already publicly owned, although as subsidiaries of other European states' national rail companies. So, for example, the German national rail company Deutsche Bahn or the Dutch state operator Nederlandse Spoorwegen. The profits made by these companies, which, as we've seen, are sustained only because of the British taxpayer subsidies, are then used to improve rail services back in Germany, France, Netherlands and other countries. So clearly the UK government today doesn't have a problem with publicly owned companies running the railways, so long as they're not owned by the UK public. There are other examples from closer to home as well. In 2009, the East Coast Line was taken into public ownership after National Express walked out of the contract. The East Coast Line had a 91% customer satisfaction rate, one of the highest in the country, and required much less subsidy than other operators, and it actually ended up paying back money to the Treasury. It was widely regarded as being one of the most efficient franchises in the UK. The success of European Railways and of East Coast Line clearly demonstrates that public ownership can be efficient and effective and is entirely possible and affordable.
Our thanks to Laurie McFarlane of the New Economics Foundation. To discuss that thesis and other theses, I'm joined in our cosy briefing room train compartment by the former Conservative Transport Minister and rail enthusiast Michael Portillo. He also, of course, presents the BBC TV series Great British Railway Journeys. Alongside him is Christian Wolmar, former transport correspondent at The Independent and author of several books on rail history. Get your feet off the seats, Christian. And also joining us is Michael Shabus, an international railway consultant, mainly working in the UK, where he helped to found one of the first private train operating companies. Michael Portillo, you've been travelling around everywhere by trains now. Why were railways nationalised in the first place?
I wasn't around in 1947, but my guess is, as was said in the report a moment ago, that all train systems are loss-making, so they were pretty much bankrupt, even though I think 1947 was the peak year for rail passengers. And also, this was a period in which so many other things were nationalised too. So it was very much the mood of the time to nationalise.
Were there any specific reasons, Christian Wolmar?
Well, the railways were incredibly run down after the Second World War. They needed considerable investment. The four private companies which then owned the railways were all heading towards making losses. And the government wanted to create a strategic transport body. So the railways became part of a wider British Transport Commission, which effectively ran the coaches, it ran lorries, and it was kind of all-encompassing.
Christian, to stay with you, we tend to associate privatisations with Margaret Thatcher. This was the great privatisation that wasn't carried out by Margaret Thatcher, but under John Major. So why didn't it happen under Thatcher, and why did it happen under Major?
Mrs. Thatcher famously didn't like trains, and so she didn't really pay much attention to them. And one of the stories I had is that Nicholas Ridley, one of her favourite ministers, one day kind of drew up on the back of an envelope a plan to privatise the railways and had a chat with Margaret and got a flea in his ear. And Margaret Thatcher said, don't ever talk to me about trains again. Later on, she did sort of half change her mind once or twice. Michael was around at the time and might be able to enlighten us.
Well, I don't think Margaret Thatcher was in the least bit anti-train. I think the reason the railways weren't nationalised was that she was actually very cautious. I mean, she had to be pulled into privatisation in general and each privatisation in particular. So this was certainly not a priority for her. But there was quite a lot of investment in railways under her. I mean, for example, the electrification of the East Coast Main Line, without which we could hardly imagine life today, was a project that was carried out under her.
My impression was that it actually was a project for the major government to have, you know, when casting around. Governments need something to do and something to... But that may be wrong, Michael.
I was working on rail privatisation in 1989, so Margaret Thatcher was still Prime Minister. But it took quite a long time after that. What I remember, interestingly, was that we had a series of options for how we might do this. And one that we had ruled out is the one that was actually implemented. So we had ruled out separating the operating companies from the infrastructure. And I'm really unable to say why it was, after I left that department, that they decided to move towards a model that we had rejected.
Well, I can help you there, because clearly it was the Treasury that drove that. The core idea was that you separated the railway so that there was an infrastructure company with the tracks and signalling or whatever, and there were operators, and then you could have operators competing against each other. And the real Treasury notion was that you sold off every train path. In other words, you know, the 9 o'clock to Leeds might be run by the Blue Company, and the 9:30 to Leeds, because somebody else had bid more, would be run by the Green Company, and maybe the 10 o'clock might be run by the Red Company. And that was actually the Treasury's nirvana. It didn't happen, and open access, as it's called, was undoubtedly a failure.
Michael Chabas.
Yeah, I'd like to come in there. Selling it off vertically integrated would not have worked. It would not have been a way to bring the kind of innovation and investment into the industry. And
now, what do we mean by vertically integrated?
Well, what happened was the Japanese railways were privatized by breaking them up into different parts. Each island has a different train company. There's one company that has the trains around Tokyo, another one that has the trains around Osaka.
And by train companies, we're not just talking about the people who operate the trains, we're also talking about the people who own the track.
They own the tracks as well. There's two problems with that model. The first problem is you can't distinguish short-term and long-term investment and performance. Railway assets last for 30, 50, 100 years. And it's very hard when you're government regulating it to do it that way. And that is the way the railways were regulated in Britain before 1947. And it worked from up until around 1935 quite well, actually. And Britain had the best train system in the world, and it was built by private companies. And the United States, arguably, well, it had the best passenger train system, too. And it was the same model. In both countries, the governments interfered and said, we are going to regulate fares and freight charges. And they did this progressively. And in Britain, by 1947, they had bankrupted these private companies.
What, by regulation?
By regulation.
I think it's worth mentioning something here because it will become relevant later. We had kind of assumed that the railways were in decline and that nothing was going to arrest this decline. So what we were trying to do was to manage a failing industry.
So you thought there'd be less of it?
Yes. Because all the evidence suggested that that was what was going to happen, because the peak year having been, I think, 1947, passenger numbers had been falling. What has happened since has taken us by surprise, I think most of us by surprise. There are now more than twice as many rail passenger journeys as there were when we were talking about privatisation.
Michael Chabas, yeah, I do want to ask you a specific question, which is that you were involved right from the beginning in bidding for the franchise to run trains. So why did you believe that you could provide a better service than British Rail was doing?
OK, if you compare the vertical single company model, which is done in Japan, you'll see over the last 30 years there's been virtually no growth in traffic. OK, in Britain, We said if you break it up into pieces, you provide lots of different routes for people to come in with investment and ideas. You provide competition. If you sell it as large chunks, as they did in Japan with the trains and the tracks all run together, it's not easy to see how you can bring new people in every 5 or 10 years.
Well, because they wouldn't be able to invest.
You have
in
to
the,
give people
in
a 30
on the infrastructure.
That's right. You have to give people 30 years or 40 years if they're going to control infrastructure investment. But operating is something you can do for 5 years or 7 years or 10 years. So what we've had in Britain is 25 train companies. The numbers varied a bit. Generally, they've had to compete every 5 to 10 years for their jobs again. That's the management, by the way, not the train drivers. And the result has been that we've had about 100 competitions, 25 times 4 over the last 20 years, to run each part of the railway better. And that's management teams saying, I've got a more clever idea about how I organize my trains, what trains I will use, how I will structure my fares, and so on.
I just want to keep on this point, which is why you felt at the time you could do a better job.
Because trains are complicated businesses, really complicated businesses. And there's always a more complicated way, a better way of doing something, but it's a little riskier, and you have to argue about it in a meeting. And working inside British Rail, which wasn't a bad organization in the public sector, you still always tended to go for the slightly safer option. And, you know, I mean safe by the one that wasn't going to get you fired.
And we're going to get into some of this. But first, it just so happens that the Transport Select Committee has recently issued a report on rail franchising. And to help us get up to date with how that's working, we're going to hear from the committee's chair, the Labour MP, Louise Ellman.
The competitive benefits that franchising promised to bring have not really materialised. We were told that franchising would introduce competition, that that would drive costs down, there would be lower fares, as well as better services, and those things haven't all been achieved. It was envisaged that when franchises were due for renewal, they would be put out to competitive tender, and the most competitive bid would be accepted. But in reality, there's been very little real competition in recent years. And since 2012, most of the franchises have actually been direct awards. And that means that the Department for Transport has continued the existing operator running those franchises, and it hasn't been put out to competitive tender at all. In other cases, there have been very few applicants. So there's been very little competition in reality.
Michael Chabas, there are several points there, but one of the main ones is that actually the competitive model that we were talking about, the competitive bidding, hasn't really happened and doesn't really work in the current situation. What do you think about that?
Well, I think people put too much attention on the idea that there would be competition for the 805 train from Woking or something like that. That was probably never going to happen, and most of us in the industry thought it was never going to happen. But there is fierce competition for the franchises every 5 to 7 years when they come up for renewal. Every year, more money, you talk about $200 million of profit going to international companies, which is about 2% of the turnover of the industry, by the way, which is a pretty small amount. More than that money is spent every year on bidding for franchises. It sounds like a lot of money to pay experts to find ways to make that railway a little more successful. It's not a waste of money at all. It's go and see the network, and compare it with any train system in the world, and you will realize that Britain arguably has the best.
Okay, so there are quite a lot of international comparative statistics we can come to in a moment. But Christian Wolmar, this point about franchise competition, now, frankly, there is a lot of competition for the franchises, or there isn't.
So. No, there's a big problem. We've just had National Express, which at one point had 9 franchises, has decided to throw the towel in on its last franchise and sold it to Trenitalia, which is an Italian state company. The problem is that because the Department of Transport has become more demanding in what it wants from the franchisees and regulating them more tightly, the opportunity to make much profit has been lost.
People are not
actually bidding for them because the private companies don't like being regulated so tightly, and they don't like having to face narrow margins. And that's the contradiction with the system, that if you try and improve the system and actually regulate it quite tightly, the private companies can't make a profit and they're not interested. But so it's all going to these state-owned companies which are owned by other governments.
But I'm left trying to reconcile what seems to be a difference in about fact, which is that either the franchises are competitive or they're not.
The fact is that some of the recent franchises have only had 2 bidders instead of 4.
Michael Portillo, from what you recall of the arguments in government about how it was likely to work and selling it to the public, has this franchise business worked in the way in which you think it was sold to the public?
Well, no, I think it has vastly exceeded anybody's expectations. You know, we would have been absolutely disbelieving if we'd been told 20 or 25 years ago that the number of passenger journeys was going to more than double. Now, it's difficult to know exactly why that has been, but I think it is perfectly fair to argue that the companies that have come on have been more innovative. People complain about the complexity of the fare structures, but actually, you know, they're online and they offer people incredible bargains, because part of what train companies have to do is they know they're going to use their trains very fully in the morning and in the evening, but you make a profit by filling the trains early in the morning, in the middle of the day and very late at night. And there you go. There are the fares to attract you in these off-peak periods.
When you can work out what they are, but...
Well, no, it's not difficult. You go online and it will tell you what the best fare is, and you simply, you know, click. It's like booking anything else. I don't know why people complain so much about that.
Christian Wilmot, Michael Portillo makes, in a sense, what becomes almost a bully point, or it feels like a bully point, which is, look... Whatever you say or we say about the mechanism of rail privatisation, the fact is we've presided over this blossoming of railway use.
Absolutely.
Now, the question, I suppose, is would we have had such a blossoming if we hadn't had the privatisation?
Well, the key point is trying to hone down on why. And there is very little that the train companies have actually done to stimulate that growth. Most of it has come from what D.L. Gordon Brown would call exogenous factors. In other words,
outside
societal factors. Like, for example, you know, increases at the beginning of this period, increases in fuel prices, in increases in the number of university students, particularly the very healthy employment levels in central London, because much of the growth, 70% of rail journeys either start or end in London. 70% start or end in London or entirely within London. And the key one, I think, and I've talked to academics about this, is the fact that in around 1995, 97, something like that, we reached sort of peak car in terms of everybody who wanted a car had bought one by then and was using it to the maximum. And there wasn't actually any more possibility of increasing the numbers of cars, whereas actually the railways had a lot of spare capacity.
Christian's not entirely wrong. There have been a lot of things that have been moving in the direction of the rail industry. But there is no other rich country in the world that comes remotely close to the success we've had in this country in improving our railways.
Christian Wilmot, you stood for the Labour Party in the recent Richmond Park by-election, and you are a keen Labour Party activist. And as we've heard at the beginning, your party has adopted rail nationalisation as an official policy. What, as an expert on rail, do you make of that?
Well, it's quite complicated. On the one hand, you know, I was a critic of privatisation. I'm still a critic of the way that the railways are set up, and I think they could save a lot of money by being run in a different way. The problem is that we are where we are. So part of the railways are already nationalised. That's the track and infrastructure. So that leaves the rolling stock, on the one hand, and operations as a third item, right? The rolling stock is being sold off to leasing companies for a long time. They're not going to get bought back. It would cost actually billions to buy them back. Nobody's going to buy them back, right? So that leaves the only bit that can be renationalised are the operations. Now, they've got long-term contracts, some of them 5 years, 7 years, some of them well into maybe a second term of a Labour government, if there were one in 2020. So it's going to be a real hassle taking them all back. They're not going to be taken back at once. So you can't recreate British Rail very quickly. So while I'm in favour of letting the franchises die out and gradually taking them back, I am in favour of that, but I don't think that this should be Labour's big transport policy, because it's not going to make an enormous immediate impact on passengers.
Michael Portillo, even the government has had to deal with the fact that, as measured by opinion polls at any rate, people suggest that they would quite like to return to nationalised rail companies. That's a strange political thing, given what you've talked, the terms in which you've talked about the success of the railways since privatisation.
Well, when you tell people that the number of train journeys has doubled over the last 20, 25 years, they are absolutely astonished. This is a very little known fact. So they begin probably not knowing that. Second thing is, a lot of people don't remember British Rail by now. And those who do, I think, are very often blinded by nostalgia. I mean, my memory of British Rail is not as fuzzy as many of the public, apparently. In the brief period that I was the Minister of State for Transport, I had to attend a lot of train disasters, unfortunately. Clapham Common, where I think about 34 people were killed. Then I went to one in Purley in South London. Then I went to one in Mill Guy in Glasgow. I also think British Rail was not responsive to customers. And at the time, you know, we joked about filthy trains and unpunctual trains and ancient rolling stocks and curly white bread sandwiches. So I don't know how people have developed a rather rosy impression of what nationalisation was like in the railroads.
Michael Chambers, we heard in Laurie McFarlane's package that the government had to step in with the East Coast Line, and that actually resulted, in that case, in improved customer satisfaction at the point when they were doing it. And to a lot of people, that became a kind of symbol that you might actually do better, taking Southern Rail as an example, if you were to follow that model and shove them out and put yourself back in.
OK, part of the problem is that the rail industry is very diverse, and the East Coast Main Line, which is an intercity line, it was electrified by British Rail in the last days of public ownership with the newest trains at the time, and a very relatively simple service pattern, has always been a very reliable railway and something that people chose to ride on as an alternative to driving or flying. Most people who ride Southern into London don't see it as having a choice. It's a distress purchase. They have to go to the station at 7:30 in the morning, and frankly, they'd rather be home in bed. Okay, they have to crowd onto a crowded train. They can't shift their journey an hour later. You really can't make these comparisons.
The whole point here is that the train operators, as the guy from New Economics Foundation said, the train operators are getting profit for no risk and no investment. And that's not capitalism. It's always what I've called it, pretend capitalism. And that's the key point.
Michael Chambers, isn't that right?
Yeah, it's also completely untrue. It's an industry on the interface between public and private, but there is enormous risk in a franchise bid. And the model is now being adopted in many countries around the world for exactly the reasons that I've said.
Michael Portillo, you like capitalism, so do you think this is pretend capitalism?
Well, I think in railways it will be pretend capitalism to some extent, whatever you do. Our railways are not going to run at a profit, as most railways in the world do not. And so what you've got to decide is, you know, how much the public sector wants to give and how it wants to give it. In the original report that we heard from Laurie McFarlane, I think I heard him say that on his calculations, the subsidy has approximately doubled since privatisation. And I would add to that that the ridership has approximately doubled. This doesn't sound like too bad a deal to me.
Now, how do you think, since you travel on trains right the way across the world, how do you think travelling on British railways compares with abroad?
You'd have to go back to basics. I mean, most continental railways were built with a wider loading gauge, which means that the wagon is wider than it is in Britain, and taller too. That immediately gives you a more comfortable ride in most countries than you get in Britain. But if we want to attach blame, we have to go all the way back to the Victorians, with the distinguished exception of Mr. Brunel, who built wide railways, but everybody else built very narrow railways, and we're still paying a cost for that today. That is really the story of high-speed rail. High-speed rail enables you to put in 21st century infrastructure and, as it were, to begin again.
Christy Morwell, do you think it is likely that in 10, 20, 30, 40 years' time we will actually substantially have altered the way we run our railways in this country in terms of ownership, structure and so on?
I think there'll be debates about private and public, which have gone on since the 19th century. But I do think that there will essentially be a railway system that is not that dissimilar, you know, 30, 40 years' time to now. You know, there'll still be trains running on two rails, maybe a bit faster, maybe with a few extra facilities. Everybody will have Wi-Fi, but they will still be whizzing around the country. And that's really amazing when you think about it. What in the 19th century do we still have in the mid-21st century? Not much.
Michael Chambers.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think things will change that dramatically. And if the railways were renationalised, I think they would probably change even less. They would stagnate. They may stagnate in private ownership too.
The survival of the technology is remarkable. Steel wheels on steel rails, that's been going since the very beginning of the 19th century. I think, sadly, we've relied too much on trying to stick to a Victorian infrastructure. We haven't recognised the need to update it. But we will gradually update it. We'll do it much more slowly than other countries. But bit by bit, we'll get there.
Well, thank you very much indeed to Michael Wattullo, to Michael Chabas, to Christian Wolmar, to Laurie McFarlane, who you heard from earlier. And that's it for this week from The Briefing Room. Next week, well, who knows? You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. My producer for this episode was Phil Kemp. The sound engineer was Rod Farker. Research was by Sam Bright. If you're looking for other quality podcasts to listen to, subscribe to a new series called Intrigue, Murder in the Lucky Holiday Hotel. It's the story of a mysterious murder that changed the course of Chinese politics, and it's based on an investigation by the BBC's China correspondent, Carrie Gracie. Just search for Murder in the Lucky Holiday Hotel, BBC. If you'd like to let us know what you think about The Briefing Room, there's an easy way to do it. Just write a review or rating on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Welt, in der sich Technologie und künstliche Intelligenz weiterentwickeln, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um Ihre Daten und Netzwerke vor Cyberrisiken zu schützen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.